Today's February 17th, 2016. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. We'll first start off today with an informational hearing with the Judicial Department, so we'll go ahead and bring folks up. Mr. Bender, do you want to give us a little introduction?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Subcommittee members. The Judicial Department is coming forward to report to you on the status of the State Court Technology Fund. State Court Technology Fund is used to support OJD's various electronic systems, and there are certain trends that are going on in terms of revenues and expenditures that they will be reporting to you on. I just wanted to point out that immediately following this, you're scheduled to take a work session on a related request relating to the current biennium budget for the current biennium budget for the State Court Technology Fund expenditures. So this initial report will help put that subsequent request into context as well.
Thank you. Mr. Lemon, please.
Mr. Co-Chair, members, I'm Phil Lemon from the Judicial Department. With me is David Moon, the Director of our Business and Fiscal Services Division, in case you have any numbers questions. Before I start, is there something I need to know about your co-pilot there, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Lemon. This right here is Mr. Snakey. It is my son, Snake. I've brought him to work today, and so we're now taking pictures with him so my son can see Snakey getting a full, you know, day at the Capitol. So he will be, you know, he's going to keep his questions to a minimum. So, but if you, you know.
We've sent back for our mongoose platoon, so we just
okay.
Want to make sure.
Excellent. Thank you.
Bring your snake to work day.
We were asked to provide a report on the status of the State Court Technology Fund, so I'm going to give you a little bit of background about the fund, talk about what's in it, and the future needs that we do have. The fund pays for many functions and services, including the Odyssey Case Management System, which is the core of the Oregon eCourt system. We are finishing implementation in the trial courts as of June of this year, and then we have a similar system of both case management and financial management in the appellate courts. We have the e-payment system where people can go online and pay their court-ordered financial obligations such as fines and penalties. That is statewide now and was an early accomplishment of the e-court program, which you helped fund. We have File and Serve, which is the system that feeds into the Odyssey case management system, and that allows remote filing of pleadings and also provides service of those pleadings on a 24/7 basis from remote locations. We have GuidanFile, which is something that we developed to particularly assist with litigants who are not represented by attorneys. It's a kind of TurboTax sort interview-based form where you fill out the questions and it populates the correct forms for the court. You can either print those out and file them, or they can be e-filed. We have OJSON, the Oregon Judicial Case Information Network, which is the system that consolidates the e-court, the circuit court system with the appellate system, and the legacy OJSON system, which provides online access to case calendars so people can go online and see when a case is scheduled. That service is free at the court kiosks, and then through a subscription basis, we have people who have access to court documents in courts that are using the e-court system. We do not allow blanket access to all documents because we do have confidential cases such as adoptions. We have confidential documents within public cases. So we have a system of allowing different stages of access to various types of users depending on their either law practice or business interest use. The fund consists primarily of two major revenue sources. One is 4.75% of court filing fees. We generally refer to those as civil cases, although it does include small claims, forcible entry and detainer, which are the landlord eviction cases, and family law cases. The other major revenue source is OJSON subscription fees, and we have received a large influx of subscribers since we went online and allowed document access. So that is a very popular service that we've been encouraging folks to use because it reduces our traffic at our court counters. We have thousands of business users in the system. That includes both OJD judges and staff. We have private sector attorneys, unrepresented litigants, prosecutors and defense attorneys in criminal cases, public agencies such as the Department of Justice and state sheriffs, and we have a wide variety of business users, including news media, debt collectors, landlords, title companies, and many other business interests. The letter goes into some detail about the kinds of costs that we have for those systems. They fall into two basic categories. One is vendor charges. We have system maintenance costs that will come online in the 17-19 biennium. And then there's a per transaction fee that is applied to, in the e-pay system, it's the person who is paying the fine is responsible for paying that fee. For e-filing, we get billed by the vendor for each e-filing envelope, but OJD pays that directly out of funds raised through the filing fee increase that was approved in 2014. Staff costs is the other major component. We have staff that support the OJSON online, which again provides the online access to those services and documents. File and serve and guide and file are both have staff components to those. Training, user support, and system support are the three major categories of those costs. We need to train both the court users and the court stakeholders so they know how to use the tools, and so get the benefits both for them and for the court that they those systems offer. We have an active help desk system, and we do a lot of outreach and training to a variety of stakeholders. The other thing that we use those staff for is business process development. And as we went out and rolled out the e-court system, and lawyers were able to practice in one county but file documents throughout the state, we found, and they found, a variety of business practices in the individual courts. And so, for example, as we rolled out e-filing, we developed a standardized acceptance policy because we found that different courts would reject e-filings for different reasons. And as a those of you who practice law know that if you do one thing one way in one court and it works fine, you do the one thing the same way in another court and it doesn't work, that is not the happy situation that we would like. And so we spent a lot of time working with the courts, working with the bar, to develop a statewide policy on how that should work, and we've reduced the rejection rate for pleadings substantially through that process. In terms, we take a number of steps to limit the costs and manage the costs. One is vendor issues. We have talked to our vendor about renegotiating the e-filing charges that we pay. They were our interested. That might be a little strong. They are willing to have that discussion, but not until we have a statewide rollout so they can see the volume and the type of e-filings that we will do. What we're looking at is see if we can, rather than a per transaction, to do a flat fee or something else where we have a little more certainty and can manage that cost. We've also worked with the vendor rather than having one document go in per envelope. In an e-filing, we can put multiple documents relating to the same case in an envelope. So that is a significant cost savings for the judicial department, and then also something we don't have to ask the users to pay for. Our choice of systems has helped manage the cost. When we first started out using an interview-based fillable form system, it was quite expensive, both in terms of contracting with the vendor. Every time we wanted a new or different form, it was a significant cost. If we wanted to change a form, it was a significant cost. And that vendor also wanted to have a user per transaction fee paid by the user for every time somebody used that form. We went to a different system where we own the form. We can change the form, whether it's in response to a legislative change or a law change or some other circumstance. There is no user fee. And so that is a significant improvement, both in the cost from the court standpoint and from the user standpoint. And again, I talked about the business process training and consistency and the filing acceptance policy, which makes the process more consistent on a statewide basis and more efficient and effective for both courts and their users. On the money side, the Tech Fund has sufficient revenue to fund all functions in the 2015-17 biennium. That's assuming that you approve the request that is for expenditure limitation that's next on your agenda. It will need additional revenue in 2017-19 and beyond. We are projecting an $8 million deficit in 17-19 and about $10.5 million in 19-21. That is in part because we have system maintenance charges in our vendor contract that come into play starting next biennium. And we also have the, as e-filing rolls out statewide, we will have additional costs as that goes up. We're looking at three sources directly related to court services as potential mechanisms to address that deficit. The first is statutory filing fees. And when we worked with stakeholders in 2013-14, again, our vendor charges us a per transaction fee. Our initial proposal was just to have the filer pay that and to take OJD out of the middle. That was not the preferred alternative by stakeholders, and so we worked with them and the legislature, so we increased filing fees, and OJD takes care of that behind, and the litigants only pay the upfront filing fee, and a percentage of that goes to the technology fund to fund e-filing services. The second major revenue source is adjacent subscription fees. We have tried to keep those low to encourage people to try the system to get used to accessing documents online and therefore reducing the request at courts and counters for copies of documents. The third option would be fines on offenses. A major part of our client base is public agencies, and particularly in the criminal justice area. And so as we apportion costs by user type and kind of who uses the service and how we can pay for those, we'll be looking at an increase in that area as well. I would just say here that we have not been exploring user fees directly charged to public agencies, either state or local governments, who are the large part of our user base. And we do not intend to do that, but if the legislature wants us to consider that, we can spend some time on that and show you what that might look like. So we will be bringing a package to you.
Mr. Lemon, if I could stop you for a second. Senator Shields.
So, Mr. Lemon, so no district attorneys would have to pay any fees for this, is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, that's correct. By statute, district attorneys do not pay for the services the court provides or for filing fees. And so that, on the e-filing side, our contract with our vendor precludes a charge for those cases. But we also, we still have that system that's set up to do that. And so we need to pay, find a way to pay for the system. But there's no direct charge either to prosecutors or to defense attorneys who spend a majority of their time on doing indigent defense work.
Okay. Yeah. Please continue.
Which brings me to my summary. So we are approaching our final implementation of the Oregon eCourt program. Our statewide implementation on the circuit court side will conclude in June. We will have wrap-up activities that will take us through the end of the calendar year, and that will give us statewide e-filing as well as every court on the same system and document access for all circuit courts as well as the tax court in the state. We appreciate the legislature's support for the eCourt program and look forward to working with you next biennium on this fun subject of revenue, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Lemon. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Bates.
Just a couple real quick, and I'm new to this budget, so I'm asking stupid questions. You feel free to tell me so, okay?
I like simple questions.
Well, but they may be dumb, too, so you can pretend you're my wife and just speak up, okay? I don't quite understand, even after listening and reading, why your revenues are so flat. It would seem to me that you should be charging people for using this service, other than just what the public looks like here. And there may be good reasons for it. It's in statute. Statute can be changed. This should be something I would think would be self-funded. You're offering a pretty good service here that a lot of people enjoy, and they should be paying for that service. The Department of Justice certainly charges us whenever we ask for an opinion. And you're doing the same thing. I just coming for general fund money all the time is tough, and I would tell you also that it's going to get tougher in 17-19 with some of the issues involved. And the other question I had was, who actually maintains this system for you?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Bates, on the first question, the revenue is flat because we are not projecting increases either in the number of users. We have not projected, we have not built into our projections any rate increase, and that will be the subject of our interim work with our stakeholders. By statute, the Chief Justice is required to come up with and this is on the user fee side, not the statutory filing fees, but on user fees, the Chief Justice is required by statute to issue a proposal, get notice and comment from the stakeholders or other interested persons, and then has the authority to adopt those fees subject to ratification in the next legislative session. So you will see that number change as our process develops. But for right now, we're not projecting any increase in the amount charged or in the number of users coming in. On the filing fees, same thing. We're projecting flat filings, no increase in the number or type of filings that would generate more revenue from filing fees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answered the question. I obviously have some work to do in the interim, and they need to start making this balance out from my point of view, just me. And the second question I asked was, who maintains the system for you?
We have some staff. It's a combination of the OJD staff and our vendor. Some of the system maintenance is done by Tyler Technologies in Texas, and then we have our own IT shop who does a variety of help desk and other network infrastructure maintenance services, things like that.
Mr. Chair, one of the things we're trying to do in IT in this state is keep our IT support in the state and not ship our money to other states. Or, for all I know, Tyler ships it to Bangladesh after it goes to Texas. And it's sort of a common theme we're looking at in DHS and OHA, trying to keep that money in the state and have jobs here in Oregon, not ship our tax dollars out to other states. That said, we got to make sure the people in the state know what they're doing, too, and get the job done. But it always concerns me when I hear we've got a vendor, another state, money's going out of state, and our tax dollars aren't here to help us.
Thank you, Senator Bates. Yes, Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Lemon, maybe you could comment or back me up or can talk on this subject. But Senator Bates, we praise the Judicial Department for picking something off the shelf and not investing in something, and that happened to be shelf was out of state, I guess, is the point. But also, I'll be willing to see what comes forth. But the main reason we supported this and funded this project was to bring court costs down. I don't know that we really talked about fees, but that was a justification was that we all supported on was based upon making the court more efficient and up to date. So you want to comment on addressing fees now and make the good senator aware that we did, the big legislature supported you strongly in taking it off the shelf and not designing something and going through all that process.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Wisnett, thank you for the question. It is a COT system, and we have, I would just say that the Chief Justice adopted guidelines that make customization a dirty word. And so we have very few of any instances where we are, this system is highly configurable, so it's set up with parameters of options that you have to have it work in different ways. But to have Tyler go back and change the system and write new code to do something totally different is something we have used very sparingly, if at all. And so we have learned as we've gone through this process that we need to be very cautious with that. As far as fees go, when we came and worked with the 2013 legislature and also in 2014, we, I think, were very clear at that point that we needed revenue to support these systems. And we have been coming back, I think, every session, whether long or short, and saying, just kind of reminding people that our revenue was fine through this biennium, but next time we were going to have to come back and talk with people again. I would just add that there is legislation in this session that would affect filing fees and also offense surcharges in some counties. And so, again, part of our work in that bill has been saying we rely on these funding sources as well for our basic electronic system maintenance, and where proposals have come in to use those to support courthouse funding, we just want to make sure that you as the policymakers are aware that all these things will come in at some point and are relying on the same people to pay those dollars.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Yes, well, Senator Bates. My clarification. I agree we should use COTS whenever we can and bring things off the shelf when we do that. Starting the system and setting it up is one thing. Maintenance is something else, and that's the question I'm really raising here. And sometimes you take it off the shelf. To get it, you've got to give the maintenance to the operation you bought it from. But that's a discussion we really should have at the time it occurs. That's probably the point I was trying to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bates. Further questions? And Mr. Lemon, I did have one question. Were there any, so you set your fees, you know, a couple of years back. The filings, we assume there's a set number. We know that that's going to phase in as you implement e-court across the state. And so you expect costs to increase in that realm. Were there any unanticipated costs that you've seen over the last couple of years?
Since Mr. Moon's the money guy,
or is this all expected?
I'll punt and put him on the spot.
Yeah.
Chair Rayfield, there's always things that shift as we've gone through the budgets and as we've implemented the system and paid for the expenditures. We did, of course, do budgets, and some of those areas have gone more than we thought originally, others less than we thought. We've stayed within the amount that we originally projected the system would cost. So we haven't had overruns of costs that were unexpected. But as I'm saying, there were little tweaks here and there. This one cost a little more, that one cost a little less. So there was things like that. As far as these items of ongoing maintenance costs, system fees, those things haven't changed. They were set in contract years ago, and they're just going to start taking place as soon as the full implementation is completed, our warranty period is completed, then we start paying our maintenance. And all along, we have these transaction fees. So they're ramping up because, just like you said, usage, volume, all those things are increasing as we would expect with a full implementation.
Okay. All right. Are there any other questions? All right. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the informational meeting and open a work session on the State Court Technology Fund expenditure limitation increase. Mr. Bender, do you want to give us a little introduction?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair and subcommittee members. The Oregon Judicial Department is requesting an increase in their other funds expenditure limitation established for the State Court Technology Fund of $5,330,000. That is to say, they're asking you to allow them to spend an additional $5.3 million from that fund during the current biennium beyond what is currently approved in their budget. They will be explaining why this request is coming forward to you now.
Okay, and Mr. Moon, it looks like Mr. Lemon quickly hightailed it out of here to give you all right. So please begin when you're ready.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name again is David Moon. I'm the Director of the Business Services at the Oregon Judicial Department. We are requesting another funds limitation increase of $5.3 million, just over that, to support the activities in the tech fund. Many of these activities were just described by Mr. Lemon in our previous report. They are largely driven by the increase in the e-file charges. When we came to the 15-17 budget setting, we discussed how we knew that there would be increases in our costs, but we didn't at that time have a really good understanding of the implementation or the usage that would eventually occur. And so now we're coming back. We have a much better understanding, and we have some experience behind us now of how frequently that system's being used, and so now we can predict a lot more comfortably what we think the ending costs are going to be. And so we're requesting an increase in our other funds limitation for this biennium for funds that we already have in that fund. If there are any questions.
Yeah. Any questions? All right, seeing no questions, we have a recommendation.
Yes, LFO does recommend that you approve the request for inclusion in the 2016 session budget reconciliation bill. To further comment on some of the things that Mr. Moon mentioned, this is largely being driven by the growth in e-filings. The e-filing charges that the department pays from this particular fund are about $5 per each envelope of information that are that is filed electronically. There are sufficient revenues to finance this during the current biennium and to leave approximately an $800,000 carry forward into the next biennium. This situation, unfortunately, will not continue next biennium. Filing fee increases that were adopted in lieu of charging the parties the $5 fee is only generating approximately two-thirds of the total charges. So we don't, there needs to be, this issue will need to be addressed on a long-term basis next session, but for the current biennium, these funds are available, and we do recommend increasing the expenditure limitation to allow primarily the e-filing charges to be paid, but to bring into balance the entire budget of the State Court Technology Fund.
Thank you. So we have a motion.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the LFO recommendation.
Yeah, Senator Shields has moved the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, motion carries. I'll go ahead and carry that to full, close the work session on the State Court Technology Fund, open a work session on the Judicial Department Federal Grant Application Justice for Families Grant. Mr. Moon.
Oh, actually, I'll turn it over to Mr. Bender first.
The Judicial Department is asking for approval retroactively of their submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Justice for a Justice for Families grant in the amount of $700,000.
Trying to get him a job. All right. Now, Mr. Moon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Moon. I'm the Director of the Business of Fiscal Services Division at the Oregon Judicial Department. And today we are requesting retroactive approval for a federal grant application. The grant is to support activities for improving the capacity of communities and courts to respond to families affected by domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, stalking, and child sexual abuse. OJD's purpose in applying is to facilitate circuit courts in Clatsop, Lincoln, Umatilla, and Jackson counties, as well as the Klamath Tribe. The grant would fund needs assessments in these counties, which would then lead to developing a multidisciplinary court and community response to those identified needs. The grant will also support the continuation of similar types of activities in the Multnomah County Family Court that was started several years ago. Grant funds will provide for full-time staff in the Judicial Department's Family and Family Court Programs Division, as well as within the Multnomah County Circuit Court. Funds will also provide training for judges and staff and smaller grants to participating counties. The grant has a 36-month term. It's for up to $700,000. It would begin this October 1st. It does not require matching funds or maintenance of effort, and the grants will be announced September 30th of this year. The grant application guidelines were made available in early December to find out if there was interest from the courts and their communities. It wasn't until the first week of January that we had determined we had enough interest to apply for the grant. However, that was too late to get this request for application in front of the interim Ways and Means, whose deadline was December 11th. We did at that time, when we had decided we were going to apply, we did submit a letter to the co-chairs of our notice of intent to apply. So we are requesting retroactive approval for this federal grant application, and if we are successful and get the grant awarded to us, we'll come back to the legislature with additional program-specific details, as well as an increased request for our federal funds limitation.
Thank you, Mr. Moon. Is there any questions? All right, Mr. Bender.
LFO recommends that you approve the request.
All right.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the LFO recommendation.
Senator Shields has moved the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion carries. I'll go ahead and carry that to full. Close the work session on the grant application. Open a work session on the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. Mr.
The Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability is requesting an increase in their general fund appropriation for extraordinary expenses of $172,000. Extraordinary expenses represent costs that the commission has incurred as a result of investigating and prosecuting cases of judicial misconduct. The budget that was approved for this agency in the regular session followed a pattern that has been the typical pattern of providing only minimal funds for actual prosecution and investigation costs. These costs are very difficult to predict, so you included approximately $18,000 of funding in the agency's base budget with the understanding that if actual prosecution and investigation costs exceeded that, the agency would need to come back and request additional funds to cover those. They are here to explain the reason for their request and ask you for additional funds.
Please begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. First of all, let me introduce myself and the people who are seated here with me. My name is Judy Snyder, and this year I happen to be the chair of the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. It's a position that rotates from year to year, so it's no particular blessing on my part. I'm one of the three attorney members of the commission. To my right is Linda Collins. She is one of the public members of the commission and has been a valuable resource to us in our work. And to her right is Susan Isaacs, who is our sole employee. Ms. Isaacs is the executive director, and she keeps everything flowing in terms of the mountains of paper we have to deal with. A very tall gentleman will be coming back into the room, and that's Judge Jim Egan from the Oregon Court of Appeals. He is one of our three judicial members. And we're before you because we have had an extraordinary year. And I know we're asking for an extraordinary additional amount of money, but it is because of a rather unique circumstance, which is virtually unprecedented. We've had two prosecutions this year of judges. And I say prosecutions because in our role as members of the commission, we process a phenomenal number of complaints against judges, most of which result in no action being taken. But there were two issues that came to our attention within the last 18 months, which had caused us concern. Prosecutions were initiated. And in that process, it results in what, in effect, is a full due process hearing, where the commission has legal representation. The judge is entitled to legal representation. And I'm not contagious, it's just allergies. And a discovery process is undertaken. We have been extraordinarily fortunate in that we have been able to persuade very talented attorneys to represent the commission, thank you very much, in these proceedings at the rate of $100 an hour. And I think someone, I believe it was Senator Bates, mentioned about the Department of Justice charging every time they have need an opinion. There are very few people who have the types of skill set that we've been able to attract who are willing to work for $100 an hour. In large part, this commission operates on volunteer time, volunteer hours. The three attorneys, the three public members, the three judges, of course, receive no compensation for their work. The two prosecutions that we had this biennium, which have been extraordinarily expensive, include one that occurred in Bend in October. And I would say that probably fit into the category of what would be a routine one-day hearing with a prompt deliberation conducted by the commission shortly thereafter. And I know that the overall expenditure for that particular process was under $14,000. At the other end of the spectrum, we had a prosecution that was almost unprecedented in the commission's history. It resulted in extensive pre-trial discovery with depositions, many of which were videoed so that they could be used at the hearing. It was a nine-day hearing. It resulted then in two full days of deliberation by the commission. Obviously, the attorneys for the parties didn't participate in that process. It then resulted in a written opinion that was 48 pages in length. And that matter is now before the Oregon Supreme Court. And there will be this next phase of the process, which involves more briefing, an oral argument before the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will make the final decision on both of those proceedings. When our request was put in early January for $172,000, we anticipated in that approximately $20,000 to get us through the appellate process that will occur over the next 6 months. Sadly, we've already had additional fees of $14,000 come in that were unanticipated. So although we have had extraordinary help from the Oregon Judicial Department, Phil Lemon, who you heard from earlier, he came and literally helped us with the technology and the running of the proceeding for the full first week. We also had the benefit of Kim Blanding's services from the Oregon Judicial Department. The Oregon Judicial Department provided security We were able to use, at no cost, the hearing room that was down in the first floor of this building for the first week of hearing and then went over to the Department of Transportation. So we've done everything possible to try to keep costs down. But the three biggest expenses, which are not able to be avoided, obviously attorney's fees for the attorneys who are representing the commission. The second major expense was the cost of discovery, court reporters, videographers. And the third major expense was literally the expense of getting the commission members to come in from the four corners of the state to participate in these proceedings. For those who came from outside of the metropolitan area, they were housed here. And again, the Judicial Department helped get us an extraordinary rate for their lodging. They've been extremely helpful. Some of us carpooled down from Portland in order to keep overhead costs down. But the bottom line is this has been just a remarkable year, and we are now $172,000 short from what was allocated, anticipating, as I mentioned, $20,000 to get through the appellate process, but we know that already $14,000 of that has been eroded. So we come hat in hand requesting an extraordinary expenditure.
Thank you, Ms. Knight.
Judge Egan, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, just that it is random and unpredictable. We couldn't possibly have anticipated that these two trials were going to take place. The last trial we had was 9 years ago, and we had two in a year. Just it's something that you can't anticipate, and it's unfortunate.
And can you just quickly identify yourself for
the record? I'm sorry. I'm Judge Jim Egan from the Court of Appeals. And I'm from Albany. I'm from where you practice law.
You're the snazziest dressed appellate court judge in Oregon.
There you go.
Wow.
There's that.
Mr. Chair, I object to your pandering to the witness.
Duly noted.
How many cases do you have in front of him? You got a couple pending, probably.
I don't do appellate work. We'll make that very clear.
Oh, okay.
Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Wisnat.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mrs. Snyder, Mrs. Collins, thanks for your work in volunteering and do this. My questions will be about expenses, not about the cases. At this time, Mr. Co-Chair, I'm a no. I'd like to work with Mr. Bender and look over the expenses. I guess we need to know what the expenses for the cafeteria lunches at the Willamette College were and what the parking lot expenses were. But seriously, too, we didn't have, the judge just said, we didn't have any extraordinary expenses for 9 years. Did that money go back into your budget, or what happened to that money that you were given for extraordinary cases or expenses?
My understanding of the way the Mr. Chair and Representative Whitson, my understanding of the way the budgetary process has historically worked is that we are given just, I guess I'll use the word bare bones budget, knowing what our average costs will be to run the office, to pay our executive director, and for the expenses associated with getting commission members to the bi-monthly commission meetings. We have no excess of any extraordinary amount unless we're actually anticipating a hearing and need to come to you to ask for extraordinary fees. In the past, we had, at the end of the biennium, less than $10,000 by my memory. I'm going from historic memory, but I remember less than $10,000 when we were asking ourselves questions like, ooh, can we afford to upgrade our speakerphone in the commission office? So there really hasn't been much to revert back to the general fund.
Thank you.
We have technical assistance, too.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is John Fagan. I'm the fiscal services manager for the Oregon Judicial Department. We provide financial support for the commission. The commission's budget is split into two areas. There's an operations side and an extraordinary expense side. Those charges that go into the extraordinary expense side are usually involved with investigations and then trials. The commission will do some investigation work during the course of a biennium based upon the type of complaints that have come forth. Many of those don't result in any trials, or it may result in some sort of agreement between the parties. So they have had extraordinary expenditures over the last 5 or 6 biennia. It's held in its own account. Any expenditures that do not get expended out of that account roll into the next biennium. Over the last about three biennia ago, the extraordinary expenditure bucket was reduced because they weren't expending all the funds. And so over time, it's been between about $10,000 to $18,000. This last biennium, because they were in the midst of an investigation, there was only about $273 that rolled over, I believe, from the last biennium to this one. So again, there is some investigation that takes place. There is nothing spent out of that extraordinary fund that isn't for investigative work or some other work. It's not spent to be able to support operations. And then again, any funds that haven't been spent always rolled over into the next biennium. And depending on how much money that was, it was either reduced from the bucket, or if it's been a minimal account, especially this last biennium, there was no changes made associated with those rollover funds.
Please.
Thank you for that information. I still have concern about, we only put $17,000 in for extraordinary expenses in the last budget, and you said the one day in Bend was typical, or and that was $14,000. So there wasn't, you know, we're a Ways and Means Committee. We're supposed to be budgeting, be sure our budget, we have enough money. So as obviously we didn't, you know, and this was an extraordinary case, I accept that, and a longer case. But, you know, the co-chair is upstairs and the leadership, we're looking at a lot of filling in some little holes with a little bit of reserve and ending balance that we did have. So I'd just like Mr. Co-Chair to look over the expenses and see why this happened and how we can do a better job of budgeting. So I'll be a no if you're going to move it today, or otherwise I'll spend some time with Mr. Bender and see what we can.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Wisman. And I did have one question. If you had only had the one Bend case, which was $14,000, would you be before the committee today asking for additional funds?
I can answer that question. The answer to the question is probably not. It would have been nip and tuck. We'd have been close. But the extraordinary, and sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisman, the costs that we incur on a rotating basis, the extraordinary costs, are generally, as the department has testified, the investigation costs for an extraordinary case every now and again. And we roll those over, like you said, every year, and they roll back into the account. But even with the trial of Judge Miller in Bend, we probably wouldn't have exceeded the $20,000 or the $18,000 mark.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a little bit different question. I think my colleague, Representative Wisnett, is right to ask about these issues, but I want to ask you why there are so few investigations. I mean, we have a fairly robust court system across the state. It's surprising to me that we would have so few cases that would move forward. Can you explain that?
Are you implying that there should be more cases against our judges, Representative?
I'm not implying. No, I'm asking a question. Because, you know, it's true that once you leave the law enforcement side, where the police are fairly out there, we don't see as many things happen at the questioning of a DA or questioning of a judge. By the way, I'm not hating on the court system. I'm just curious about this.
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Gorsuch, let me suggest there's a couple of reasons that have led to that opinion. It's like a funnel, and we get an extraordinary number of complaints that come in, usually from a litigant who has lost in a proceeding. And we find, and I'm not going to be able to quote statistics, it would be anecdotal, but vast majority of those complaints do not implicate the judicial code. They're rather a disgruntled litigant. We then have, every time we sit to review these cases, we have a handful where we know that we need input from the judge to find out what happened, may seek the judge's written response to the accusation, or at a minimum, listen to the disk of the hearing or the proceeding in question to be able to develop enough information to form our own opinions. Much of the investigation, like listening to the disk of the proceeding, is conducted either by our executive director as part of her normal operating process, or is conducted by members of the commission. I've even myself gone out to various county courts and have met with people in order to get a further information about what has transpired. As we get further down in the funnel, when we do find issues that raise concerns that there has been, if not a violation of the code, but someone coming right up to the edge, we may bring that to the judge's attention and suggest that in future similar proceedings they modify their behavior. It's only truly those circumstances in which we believe that there's been a violation of the code that warrants a full due process hearing that we then would proceed with a complaint. Again, in my experience in the now fifth year I'm on the commission, even after a complaint has been proposed, the majority of the judges faced with those complaints will approach us and find a way to resolve those issues with a retirement, with an acceptance of a reprimand, or other acknowledgement of the error they made. So it is, what's unusual is to actually have the full due process hearing.
Okay.
That doesn't mean we're not busy.
Great. May I pitch in?
Yeah, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Our Representative Groves asked, let me also tell you that Ms. Schneider correctly said that she hasn't done an analytical study where she's done the numbers. Yeah. I've actually started to keep track of the numbers. Yeah. Over 50% of our cases are criminal defendants who are simply mad. They're just angry that they got convicted. And some of those actually end up in investigations because there was a problem. Another 20 to 30% of the cases that I've actually started to keep track of, pro se litigants who simply do not understand the process and are just complaining about the process. When we get down to the 20% or so that are lawyer, the 10 to 20% that are lawyers actually making complaints, we actually ask defense counsel what happened. We ask prosecutors what happened before we ever go to the judge sometimes. And then we ask the judge. Most of those things simply resolve with it was clearly was not a violation of the code. And that's the narrowing that Ms. Schneider is talking about. It just funnels down to the point where we have fewer than 1 in 10 in the 25 or 30 that we have this coming Friday. I think I only have questions about 2. Okay. And those are just questions. Those won't lead to investigations necessarily, but only questions about 2.
So we have Representative Krieger and then Representative Wisnett.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been a pretty strong advocate of the courts for a long time. Worked for those pay increases some years back, and definitely on board again for that when I have good, competent judges. Mm-hmm. But I do know of a case in Curry County some years ago that really disappointed me. And I spoke to Judge Brewer about it and explained to him specifically what had happened. He said, well, they should have known that. Well, obviously they didn't because the proper action was never taken. I also was talking this morning to OSP, and they're already planning on a 5 to 10% cut with this nearly $2 to $3 billion hole we got coming. And I'm not going to support anything that's going to come out of that ending balance or any excess funds that we have right now. Whether or not you should have planned for it in the future or carried a bigger balance yourselves, I don't know.
Thank you. Mrs. Snyder, you mentioned Judge Miller, so I'll not.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
You mentioned Judge, the Ben case was Judge Miller. How does the commission decide this is the issue about the statement in the voters pamphlet, right?
Yes.
How does the commission decide, why didn't that go to the ethics commission, which would have been cheaper and less time consuming than the judges? As the judges they automatically jump to this judicial system?
Well,
to me, that was a political charge, and it should have gone to ethics instead of coming to the commission.
Go ahead.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative, wasn't it? The answer is it went to both, and we are charged under the Code of Judicial Conduct to investigate all matters concerning judicial candidates as well as judges themselves, and interestingly enough, that came down to the the application of two separate provisions of the Oregon Judicial Code, one of which cannot be applied to judicial candidates and one that can.
Thank you.
So that's why it goes to both. And that's a really fascinating legal question as to whether or not after a judge is charged and becomes a member of the bar, let's say a judge resigns or a judge is dismissed, can they then be charged under the by the not the Ethics Commission, but by the Oregon State Bar for a violation of the code as it applies to lawyers? And the answer that I'm seeing is, yeah, it's possible.
That comment is that, thank you for that clarification. And I think the issue was the military statement that he made. As a retired member of the military, we were always subject, officers are to double.
Yeah, you and me both. Yeah, you bet.
So, and just a little bit of an editorial. You don't often hear a lawyer say a fascinating legal question. Wait a second. Never mind.
Really?
They're all fascinating.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question.
Yes, Representative Gorsuch, if you'd like to attack the judicial branch.
All judges in Oregon would come potentially through this process if there was a complaint, right?
Everybody but municipal court judges. Interestingly enough, municipal court judges are not subject to the Code of Judicial Conduct.
So is that just up then to the individual? Oh, follow up,
please.
Is that up to the individual city council or to do that sort of thing?
There, Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Representative Gorsuch, the answer is they're subject to the bar code.
Okay.
But they're not subject to the Oregon Judicial Code, and that's a weird case. It's like from
very unusual.
30 or 40 years ago. Yeah.
So even juvenile court judges would come under this.
Right. They're all circuit court judges.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions?
A couple quick ones. What's our total budget?
Oh, well, the total budget, again, there are two separate budget items. One is for the regular operations, and one is for the specific extraordinary expenses associated with prosecuting and investigating complaints. This would increase their total budget to approximately $190,000 in total for the investigation and the prosecution. I believe that their operating budget is less than that. The operating budget consists primarily of funding a single executive director on a half-time basis. So the actual ongoing and associated costs, there are of course other costs associated with that process.
Well, I have to assume most of the work they do is volunteer judges and volunteer attorneys on the commission.
And public members.
Public members working for free, taking time to do this, and now they have this extraordinary case that's got them hammered here. Well, I think it's kind of an unusual situation, unless we're seeing a pattern amongst judges that we're going to see more and more of this stuff, which I hope to God we don't. It's okay. This really is an unusual situation. In your total budget, how much? The biennial?
Co-chairs, Senator Bates, the total allocation for the commission is $230,038. Presently.
For the biennial, right?
Mm-hmm. Biennial.
Yeah. Thank you for the good work you do.
Thank you.
78 opportunity grants.
Is there any further discussion?
Just one more thing.
The judge.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. To follow up on Senator Bates, that could mean then that in the next biennium, we wouldn't have any of these kinds of requests. In fact, it sounds like for 9 years, we didn't have a lot of this sort of thing. Yeah. In the extraordinary operations.
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair, is Representative Gorsuch, that's correct. We haven't had hearings on a regular basis.
Okay.
It's a process we have little control over. I've teased that I'm the chair this year, and my goal is to get through the year without having a hearing. But I can assure you that if we have a concern, we have an obligation to enforce the judicial code, and we will proceed accordingly.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
All right. Any further comments? Representative Barker, would you like to get in on this? Okay. Mr. Batcher.
LFO recommends that you approve the request for inclusion in the 2016 session budget reconciliation.
Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the LFO recommendation.
Senator Shields has moved the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, seeing no discussion, are there any objections? All right. Please note that Representative Krieger and Representative Wibsnit object to the motion. The motion carries, and we don't need a carrier for this motion, so we'll go ahead and close the work session. And that is on it for our agenda day, so we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting.
Thank you very much. Thank you.